The 1999 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents Session 327, Homosexuals in the RLDS Church, a Progress Report, a paper by William D. Russell with comments by Bob Dow.
And then the response after Bill's presentation will be from Bob Dow, who is a professor of philosophy at the University of Utah, and has published on this topic. And he comes originally from Iowa, but is not RLDS. He's Presbyterian. So we'll have several perspectives here today.
Thanks very much, Ron. I've always enjoyed Ron very much. And I remember well our first meeting. It was at the MHA in Ogden in 1982. Ron was working with the Seventh East Press at BYU. I think I was their only subscriber in Lamoni, Iowa, as far as I know. Was that the official BYU newspaper?
Yeah, we would have hoped so.
They'd hoped so, but apparently unofficial. I remember Mel Smith's presidential address that year, and I recall very interesting people I met for the first time that year. I served on a panel with Mark Hoffman, and the panel was on his finding, the Joseph Smith III blessing document. My basic thesis was this: Mark, I'm sorry you found the damn thing. And, well, he is too, I guess. at least he hasn't been back since. I've kind of wondered if it was something that I had said. But I also met Lori Winder and Peggy Fletcher and Susan Oman at that MHA, all Sunstone editors. At the Hoffman panel, they were sitting in front of Dick Howard, the RLDS historian. Dick didn't know these three journalists were sitting right in front of him. And Dick was the only Mormon RLDS-type historian that I know who was suspicious of Mark Hoffman from the beginning. And so while Mark was explaining how he found the document, these three new friends of mine overheard High Priest Dick Howard behind them saying several times, "Bullshit." If Dick had known this was going to end up in print, I think he would have selected a different word. So anyway, I woke up this morning and found out in the Salt Lake Tribune my paper had already been covered, and so I thought, well, it's history, so I wrote a whole new paper on a different subject. I have a friend named Kevin who served in the Navy in the early 1970s. While in the Navy, he was impressed with a friend who spent a lot of his spare time studying the scriptures. When they were out to sea and docked in various ports around the world, Kevin was impressed that his friend Jeff would go sightseeing in the cities rather than joining his friends at the whorehouses that are popular with many of our fine young men in blue. Kevin began attending church with Jeff in San Diego. He was impressed with how the people in Jeff's congregation cared about each other. Among the people he met, interestingly enough for me, were my future mother-in-law and future father-in-law, Don and Lucille Beach. Kevin decided to be baptized in the reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints with headquarters in Independence, Missouri, not to be confused with a church with a similar name with headquarters in a tall building a few blocks from here. When Kevin was discharged from the Navy, he stayed in San Diego, got married, and was ordained a deacon in the RLDS priesthood. But there was one aspect of his personhood that made marriage and priesthood a very uncomfortable fit. Kevin was gay. The marriage was short-lived. When he and his wife separated, my future in-laws invited him to stay in a mobile home in their backyard. Don and Lucille Beach pretty well knew that Kevin was gay, and Kevin more or less admitted it to Don, but that didn't diminish their love for him. Kevin lived there for about a year before leaving San Diego and dropping out of activity in the RLDS Church. 10 years later, in October 1984, Kevin had ended up back in his hometown in the eastern part of this great country of ours and had begun attending the RLDS church there. His home congregation, which I'm going to call Liberty to protect the guilty, scheduled a weekend spiritual retreat at the Kirtland Temple. When they arrived at the Kirtland Temple, the person who opened the door was Kevin's old Navy friend, Jeff. Kevin had not seen or heard from Jeff in 10 years. Jeff had taken an unpaid job as a tour guide at the temple. And if the reports of Bill Hartley and Dean Jesse are to be believed, and I believe them, Jeff was a very good tour guide. But Jeff's religious fanaticism would cause him to develop a cult in Kirtland. Kevin became a member of Jeff's. Jeff taught Kevin into staying, and Kevin's beginning was merely a scripture study group, which seemed innocent enough. Jeff gradually attracted more people into the group. The remarkable thing about Kevin is that of the 15 adults in his group, Kevin was the only one in the group who left when Jeff began to suggest that they would have to kill people in the name of God. Kevin literally fled, fearing for his life, with only the clothes on his back and the scriptures which he loved. He called law enforcement authorities in his hometown. His action and the action of the late Dennis Yarborough, the chief of police in Kirtland, may have saved the lives of several RLDS families that lived near the temple, including that of the stake president, Dale Luffman, who's now one of the 12 apostles in the RLDS church. But a year later, Jeff would shoot and kill a family of five who were among his 28 followers. Jeff believed that he killed them according to God's will, as revealed in the Holy Scriptures. Kevin stayed away from the Liberty congregation after he fled Kirtland. I met him when we both testified for the defense at Jeff's trial in September 1990. I met with him about three more times over the next 5 years and began to detect that he was getting interested in the church again, and especially in the Book of Mormon. Eventually, Kevin began going to church again in his home congregation. The saints were very welcoming of him. But because of the church's traditional views on homosexuality, Kevin had a few dates with women, which concerned his housemate of 2 or 3 years by this time, his housemate and companion, Ray. But Ray began to attend the church eventually with him, and Ray was accepted by the saints, and it was no secret among the saints that Kevin and Ray were more than friends. Kevin began holding Wednesday evening Book of Mormon study meetings at his home, inviting all interested members of the congregation. He still holds these meetings several years later. Eventually, Ray was baptized in the fall of 1997, because he, like Kevin, had found this congregation very welcoming. In April of last year, Kevin and Ray attended the RLDS World Conference in Independence. They were thrilled with President Grant McMurray's sermon, especially this statement: "We struggle with the proper way of expressing the sense of calling and giftedness of persons with varying lifestyles and orientations, including those who identify themselves as gay and lesbian. We often do not speak openly of this issue. Tonight I will. Let me make a heartfelt plea with all of you, whatever your views on this difficult issue may be. In a world that cannot come to common ground on any of the medical, psychological, cultural, and social issues that swirl around this topic, the church cannot be expected to have those ready answers. But here's what we can expect: that every person who walks through our doors will be received with open arms. We will listen to their life stories of every person who graces our fellowship and embrace them in love. On this, there can be no compromise." End of McMurray's quote. On one day during the World Conference, Kevin had lunch with Apostle Dale Luffman, whose life he may have saved. And during that lunch, Dale introduced him to President Grant McMurray, who was sitting at a table nearby. As they parted, President McMurray hugged Kevin. Possibly in that moment, Kevin felt his worth as a human being affirmed as it had never before been affirmed in his life. 3 months later, Kevin told me, "I'm 46 years old, and finally I feel a part of a community that loves me." After a lifetime of rejection, he had found his congregation to be loving and accepting, and the hug from the president of the church was icing on the cake. The official policy of the RLDS Church is that a homosexual can be in the priesthood if she or he is not a practicing homosexual. Well, Kevin and Ray do practice, and yet shortly after World Conference, Kevin's pastor recommended that Kevin be ordained a priest. According to church policy, Kevin should not be in the priesthood, but the pastor recommended him anyway. Kevin is one of the kindest human beings I've ever known. The people in his congregation certainly know him, view him very similarly. Do you think that if you were in their shoes, you would vote against this ordination simply because his sexual orientation is contrary to church policy with regard to ordination? Of course not. No matter what some sentences might say in some thick anthology of ancient writings, and no matter what some administrative policy might say, I trust that you would rise above Scripture and rise above church policy and do what you would know in your heart was right and vote yes. That is what the people of Kevin's congregation and district did, and Kevin was ordained a priest last fall. The RLDS Church has traditionally held the typical American Christian attitudes toward homosexuals. When it became known that a man in the priesthood was gay, the normal practice would be that he would be silenced from his priesthood office, and normally he would cease church activity altogether, often just dropping out of sight. I probably should say a few words about the difference as I see it between the two priesthood systems. You know, with the LDS making it automatic for adolescent boys to be ordained to various Aaronic offices, and by ordaining all active boys who appear in the surface to be worthy, it seems to me that priesthood status by itself is not all that important in the LDS Church if to those members who possess the physical characteristics that we identify as male. But for the RLDS, priesthood is not automatic at any age. Even before women were ordained, a man could be a lifelong active member, not smoke, drink, swear, hang out with wild women, or do anything that might make them seem unworthy, and still never be called. The reason for that is that for him to be called to the priesthood, some ecclesiastical officer, usually his pastor, would have to believe that he had received some evidence that God had called this man to this office. And he had to be called to a particular office. And since there was no starting point, deacon, there wasn't a starting point particularly, then that could be the hardest part. You know, she's called to serve, but in what office? I think the RLDS person who does not get called to the priesthood is in a position similar to your adult Aaronics. Since the Aaronic offices are automatic for the apparently worthy LDS males, it is a failure to be called to the Melchizedek level and not to the priesthood itself. It seems to me that this is why the LDS and RLDS church officials act differently when people do something really naughty, you know, like attend Sunstone or the Mormon Women's Forum or research about the operations of the general authorities or pray to our grandmother in heaven or criticize church officials for heavy-handed administrative actions. The RLDS are more likely to silence the offender from his priesthood. We're more likely to silence him from his priesthood, but the LDS, of course, the severe silence is excommunication, removing the offender from membership. You really haven't done much to an adult Aaronic if you say, hey, we'll take away this priest status which you share with 500,000 16-year-old boys. So to illustrate, this spring at Graceland, an LDS student, we had just two LDS students, to my knowledge, ever, and they're there this past year. And this LDS student, who I presume is a priest, maybe an elder, but probably a priest, I suppose, he stole some paint from the college, painted 5 homophobic statements in various places on campus, and dumped the remaining paint on a student's car, a close friend of the person who the statements were about. Well, I suspect he would be kicked out of school immediately if he was at BYU. Several of you have affirmed that. I doubt that his acts would cost him his status as an Aaronic priest in the Osceola, Iowa ward. In 1954, a highly respected RLDS apostle, George Mesley, was outed as a homosexual. He was the brother-in-law of a member of the First Presidency, F. Henry Edwards, making him Paul Edwards' Uncle George. My father's favorite apostle, and mine as well, I have to say, too. Mesley resigned from the 12 and from church appointment. He remained a churchgoer, was but silenced from the priesthood entirely. Possibly because of the gay apostles case in the 1960s, the church's Standing High Council spent a lot of time wrestling with the issue of homosexuality. The High Council is often asked by the First Presidency to study difficult moral or ethical issues and make a recommendation. On this matter, they were asking questions like, should a priesthood member found to be homosexual be silenced from his priesthood calling? Should he be allowed to continue as a member? Is homosexuality grounds for divorce? We were just beginning to expand the grounds for divorce beyond the what I call the Matthew exception of adultery. Their conclusion was that homosexuality was an illness and an abomination. Certainly a homosexual could not be in the priesthood, and their membership might even be in question, according to the council at that time. There was an assumption that a person might experiment with homosexuality in their youth, so that wouldn't be a terrible problem, but the issue was, did it stick? Did it become a persistent practice? The council members also seemed to share the common assumption at the time that the persistent homosexual would tend to molest children. There seemed to be no differentiation between homosexuality and pedophilia. Their views were consistent with the American culture of the time. Possibly as a result of the High Council's policy recommendation, the First Presidency sent a letter to all pastors in about 1964 telling them that homosexuals should not be ordained. A friend of mine recalls the reaction of Joe Campbell, who was a pastor of a small rural congregation near Lamoni. He said to my friend, "Well, what if God calls a homosexual?" You know, since a special call is for each person. Asked Pastor Campbell, unimpressed with the administrative ultimatum from Independence. In the Saints Herald, the policy was reaffirmed in 1971. During the 70s and 80s, as the issue of homosexuality began to get more public attention, you know, beginning with the Stonewall Rebellion in 69, we began to raise the issue in more public consciousness. And at the same time, the RLDS Church was moving toward mainstream Protestantism and away from its sectarian, you know, we are the one true church mentality. A greater tolerance toward other churches usually accompanies such a sociological shift. It was to be expected that past anti-gay policies would come under criticism. The first presidency appointed a task force on human sexuality. Kenneth Robinson drafted the committee report, which took a liberal view. The intention was to present the committee report for discussion at a conference of high priests in the 70s that was to be held at Graceland College in 1981. The report viewed homosexuality as a civil rights issue. It stated that sexuality is God-given and that responsible sexual relations are holy. It suggested that homosexuals can be leaders in the church and concluded that homosexuals who abstain would certainly be eligible for the priesthood. They did not support gay marriage, however. But the first presidency, you know, planning to discuss this at the High Priest's 70s Quorum, got cold feet and decided not to push it at that conference. The policy that the Standing High Council finally recommended was essentially the first presidency's cautious policy. That policy of 1982 is still the policy today, which is that a gay person can be in the priesthood only if she or he is celibate. Homosexual acts are stated to be immoral. There is no distinction between promiscuous relationships and committed monogamous relationships. Persons who engage in homosexual acts should not be ordained, and if already ordained, they should be silenced from the priesthood. Just a couple of years ago, the Standing High Council again looked at the policy. They were more liberal than in earlier days, that is, the membership as a whole, and they were torn between their support for gay ordination and their non-support for gay marriage. And they were troubled by the apparent inconsistency of the two policies, and they just couldn't come to a consensus. So they made no report. Probably most people would conclude then that their inaction means that the conservative 1982 Standing High Council policy remains the church's policy. Others might argue that the 1990s High Council failure to agree on a policy means that the church at present has no policy. That would be the ideal from the liberal perspective on the matter, leaving it to the local jurisdictions to handle the issue as the saints in that area, along with their leaders, see fit. Of course, that's what we're doing anyway. But maybe we can learn from two models in recent past. The 1984 change in policy on women's ordination came by way of revelation, which was presented to the conference and so forth. Klaus Hansen last night in a discussion said, well, this is the hierarchy approach. But the result was about a fourth of the active members in the church left. We really hadn't been prepared by the president or anybody else for this very well, it seems to me. Another change we have made is to officially embrace open communion rather than the previous official policy of closed communion, where only RLDS baptized members could partake of the sacrament. The official policy changed in 1994 by way of a World Conference resolution, but the practice had already changed. Over the previous 20 years or more, many local congregations had quietly begun serving non-RLDS people, even though that was contrary to church policy. And I know of no one who left the church over open communion. So Klaus would call this the lowerarchy approach. I mean, this policy changed from the bottom up. And so possibly the open communion model is much better to affect change on the ordination, on the women's, on this issue. Granted, the fundamentalists who left in the late 1980s were not around to kick up a fuss over open communion in 1994. They weren't delegates. They were out of the church, many of them. But the practice of letting local sentiments govern the matter is less divisive and allows for more stable change to occur in an institution, and it also allows for greater decentralization, if you like that. For those who favor gay and lesbian acceptance, there have been very many positive signs, it seems to me, in addition to the positive statements that have been made by President McMurray. And I've chosen briefly 12 rays of hope, reflecting the light that radiates from the 12 apostles. First, For at least 14 years, there has existed an RLDS organization of gay and lesbian members and their straight supporters. GALA, or Gay and Lesbian Acceptance, is its name. GALA began in the early 1980s when a group of RLDS gay men in the Independence area began to meet for discussion. Early on, a retreat was planned and held, 18 people at the first retreat. Currently, about 500 people receive their quarterly newsletter, most people strong supporters, some being institutional church people who they feel should receive it, although most of them are those who asked to receive the newsletter. GALA holds an annual international retreat and several regional retreats each year. My wife and I attended a GALA retreat in Chicago of April of this year. There were about 50 or 60 people in attendance. About two-thirds were gay or lesbian. GALA is not an official RLDS organization, but three of the leaders of the retreat were RLDS World Church appointee ministers. Secondly, at the 1998 World Conference, the GALA activities were listed in the official program of the conference, and they were allowed to have an official booth at the conference, allowing them to discuss their issues openly with the delegates that were there for the conference. A memorial service for AIDS victims was held during the conference at the Stone Church, the mother church of the RLDS Church. Retired RLDS church historian Dick Howard, having recovered from his experience with Mark Hoffman, and his wife Barbara, conducted a worship service that was attended by many conference delegates, including President McMurray and his wife Joyce. On the last full day of the conference, a very positive discussion was held regarding the work of the Human Sexuality Task Force. Most delegates who spoke advocated toleration and acceptance. There was no vote taking on any issue, though. Third, Grayson College has also, by vote of our faculty meeting, the Alumni Council, and the Board of Trustees, added sexual orientation to its list of categories people who are assured of non-discrimination. The faculty vote was 84% in favor. Only two LDS faculty were among the eight faculty who voted no. Fourthly, another encouraging sign is the creation in the last 3 years of a student group at Graceland, a Gay Straight Alliance. The organization has become fairly visible and active on campus. Several lesbian couples are out on campus, but the same is not true of the gay men. Fifth, the recent painting of homophobic statements on the campus that I referred to, we treated like hate crimes. Naming a particular student, I will call him George, not Paul's uncle though, the painting said things like, George is gay, George is my bitch. And one of the artist's constructions was a penis and placed George's name on it. While I regret that the painter of these obscene statements was not expelled from school, as BYU would have done, the vote for expulsion was 3-3, one of the several penalties that was imposed on him was to write a letter of apology to the Gay Straight Alliance on campus. I chair our disciplinary council, and it was one of the three votes to expel, and when I explained why we imposed apology as a requirement, he had a hard time getting it. If these paintings had merely been the typical graffiti about a rival college, you know, BYU sucks or something like that, I'm sure the penalty would have been far, far less. Or William Jewell, I guess more appropriate, William Jewell sucks or whatever. Okay, many of the encouraging signs, though, are at the local level. Sixth, in some localities, Kevin's congregation being one of them, the policy on gay ordination is being ignored. For example, the president of the St. Louis stake has announced on more than in one occasion, and I've heard it in the presence of the apostle and the president of several apostles and president of the church, that he would engage in civil disobedience and resign his world church appointment if he ever was forced to enforce the church's policy on gays in the priesthood. Seventh, the St. Paul, Minnesota congregation openly declared itself, and this was published in the official Saints Herald, as an inclusive and welcoming congregation, and announced their decision in the pages of the Herald. They affirm they will not discriminate in the manner of ministry in the congregation, and one of the leaders in the congregation is a lesbian woman who I know fairly well. Eighth, the congregation that Kevin and Ray attend, which is obviously ignoring the policy, has grown. Hearing about the acceptance Kevin and Ray have experienced in their congregation, several gay and lesbian people from other denominations have joined their congregation, or at least attended. I don't know if they've joined yet. The congregation also attracted new heterosexual persons who want to be part of such a congregation that's inclusive. Contrary to fears that accepting gays might drive away the heterosexuals, Kevin's congregation is growing. Up the road here in Boise, Idaho, it was the RLDS Church which offered the use of their building, to a local gay community church which was having a hard time. All the other denominations were turning them down, trying to find a building to rent. I read about this in the Salt Lake Trib a few years ago. Tenth, several church jurisdictions in California and maybe and probably elsewhere not only ordain known gays and lesbians, but have chosen some to pastor their congregation. In fact, I know one in the East who was openly known and was gay and was pastored. 11th, and in a dramatic recent development, the San Francisco-based stake has recently begun a mission of people in the Castro district, a world-renowned gay community within San Francisco. The congregation began holding worship services on June 20th, last month, renting a Lutheran church. The stake plans to build a church in the Castro district, which will be both a coffee house and a place of worship. Interesting enough, about 15 years ago, the stake had sold a church building that was too close to the Castro district. Times do change. Okay, finally, the 12th ray of hope that you've all been waiting for. A number of lesbian and gay couples have had their marriages solemnized by RLDS priesthood in unofficial commitment ceremonies. My stake president, Lamoni, is very supportive and recently attended a commitment service for a homosexual couple. Although the church has no official recognition of such services, it appears they are becoming more common. One lesbian couple in Indianapolis attended to have a quiet commitment service, inviting only those they felt secure were supportive. But as the word got out in the congregation, many members in the congregation asked if they could be invited because they wanted to share in the support for this couple. The priesthood office, which we used to call patriarch, we now call evangelist, because you don't want to call a woman a patriarch, I suppose. What used to be called patriarchal blessings are now called evangelist blessings. We used to allow only one patriarchal blessing per lifetime, which was usually given about when a man or woman was beginning adulthood. So unless you were a cat, you had only one blessing. Now we approve of having evangelist blessings more than once in your life. So if a special need comes up later, divorce, big career decision, whatever, another evangelist blessing is now quite appropriate. The general authorities, as you would call them, have discussed the idea of approving of having an evangelist blessing to gay or lesbian couples who have committed themselves to each other. They have not yet announced any recommendation or any suggested any policy, but for several years there have been occasional commitment services, like I just said, and I understand there have been a very few already where evangelists have given an evangelistic blessing to a particular gay or lesbian couple. I'm sure it's very few so far in that category, but there have existed, according to a good source, a friend of mine. I have reflected recently on the importance of commitment ceremonies, probably because my wife and I were married 2 years ago this month. There were about 175 people attending. Rather than the usual triumphal grand entrance of the bride, Lois and I quietly entered the sanctuary through the back door and came down through the pews, shaking hands or hugging every person there. Paul Edwards was so special, I gave him a kiss. literally, I did, that's true. Each person was a cherished friend or family member, one or both of us. These greetings symbolized our appreciation for the support these people have been to us in the past and are at present with regard to our decision to commit our lives to each other. It was a wonderful worship service, but the first 15 minutes where we showed our appreciation to those who loved us was the best part for me. Here at Sunstone, about 15 years ago, a presenter asked a question which has crossed my mind many times and probably more often since my wedding. That is, if the saints value love and lifetime commitment like we tell the world we do, why does the church withhold its blessing simply because the two people happen to be of the same sex? It is the same question I asked in the early 1960s of the RLDS people and of the good people of Independence, Missouri regarding interracial couples. And I think the answer obviously is the same. It saddens me to think how most gay and lesbian couples are denied the opportunity to have the kind of public expression of love and support that Lois and I had. Perhaps I shouldn't be surprised at the depth of the feeling of appreciation I have seen in gay and lesbian couples when I've expressed my support to them, my joy at their happiness. I highly recommend that you verbalize your support to gay and lesbian friends. To be sure, the news is not all good. We could well lose this battle. There are still priesthood being silenced for being gay. One, Randy, was a student of mine, graduated just a few years ago, an outstanding student and a wonderful person. Randy represents the very best among Graceland's graduates. 3.93 GPA, but more than that, a wonderful person. The church has been very important to his life. The pain of his silencing has been very hard for Randy and his family and friends to bear. His mother, a dedicated church member, resigned her priesthood in support of Randy and will resume her priesthood duties only if and when Randy's priesthood is restored. When my wife and I recently stood arm in arm with Randy, tears flowing down her cheeks because words failed us, I wondered if church administrators have any idea the pain they inflict on good Christian people when they enforce rules that are based on principles which are contrary to the moral teachings of Jesus, who taught the worth of all people, especially the outcasts of society. The official position of the church on priesthood remains: a homosexual can be in the priesthood only if she or he is not a practicing homosexual. But this policy is breaking down as the church in a significant number of jurisdictions is ignoring the policy and ordaining known homosexuals to the priesthood and not silencing from priesthood offices gay and lesbian priesthood members who reveal their orientation. Commitment ceremonies, though unofficial, are becoming more common and have gained a surprising amount of support. Attitudes are changing, and the church appears to be in the middle of a change in practice. But it's not certain the battle will be won or whether it will be a bloody one, like the ordination of women. But it appears that McMurray is trying to carefully lead the church toward becoming a fellowship of people who provide a safe place for gays to worship and fellowship as respected members of the body of Christ. And when he became president, he chose as his first choice for the new counselor in the presidency none other than Ken Robinson, the person who wrote the liberal policy in 1978 that was not pushed forward. It is my opinion that a majority of the seriously homophobic members of the church left over the battle on women. And while this struggle over gays will be difficult, it will be less traumatic, I believe, and with relatively fewer losses. And the losses might be balanced, possibly, by gain of a policy of toleration. We used to publish our version of the Articles of Faith, and it served as an unofficial creed. I haven't seen it for many years in our churches. What comes the closest to a creedal statement now are the words you find posted in many of our congregations today. We proclaim Jesus Christ and promote communities of love, hope, peace, and joy. Grant McMurray has said that we should think of ourselves not so much as a church with a prophet, but as a prophetic church. So in the final analysis, it doesn't matter if the church gains or loses members. If we are to serve the God we worship, a God of love, a God of hope, a God of peace, and a God of joy, we will do what is right without regard to whether it gains or loses members. If we are to be a prophetic church, we will break down the dividing wall that separates our gay brothers and sisters from us, a wall which also separates us from God. And if we are prophetic people, we will break down those walls without waiting for the prophet or for the church hierarchy or for the general conference to be prophetic for us. Thank you.
Well, I really loved Professor Russell's paper. It made me optimistic. I like the idea of the bottom-up prophecy, and I personally think that it's inevitable that it will go in the direction that he described, kind of along the same lines as racial civil rights, with lots of casualties along the way, unfortunately. Probably will take a long time. But I think it is going to happen. In my own denomination, the Presbyterian Church, it's a very similar sort of situation, and it's very similar in other Protestant churches that I'm aware of as well, that official policy prohibits practicing homosexuals from holding church office. But a number of denominations have people in them, like Kevin, and they violate the policy. Some of them proclaim it loudly, and others do it quietly. So it's hard to know exactly how many are actually doing it, certainly more than would be obvious. And the reason they violate the policy is that when you get to know a person like this, a person like Kevin, and see, this is a good person, this is a kind person, this is a person who works hard in the church to do Christian service, in a loving fashion. It's just awfully hard to imagine how what they do in their sexual lives privately and responsibly really has very much to do with it. And that's the way I think about it. But I wanted to kind of set up a little bit of dialogue between that position, which I think we both hold, and the other side, the more doctrinally driven side. I came across an article by Dallin Oaks. So this will be from an LDS doctrinal perspective, and I am not sure how close or far that is from the RLDS position. So let me just read a few things directly from that paper that kind of established the doctrinal basis for the LDS Church's position on homosexuality. So I'm just reading from this now. Without the bonds of marriage, sexual indulgence is a debasing sin, abominable in the sight of deity. God created us male and female. Gender was an essential characteristic of our existence prior to our birth. Our eternal destiny, exaltation in the celestial kingdom, is only available to a man and a woman who have entered into and been faithful to the covenants of an eternal marriage in a temple of God. Through the merciful plan of our Father in heaven, persons who desire to do what is right, but through no fault of their own are unable to have an eternal marriage in mortal life, we'll have an opportunity to qualify for eternal life in a period following mortality if they keep the commandments of God and are true to their baptismal and other covenants. God has given us agency, the power to choose between good and evil. Although the conditions of mortality can limit our freedoms, no mortal or spiritual power can deprive us of our agency. Now, I think those are the sort of the main doctrinal points that he argues from there. So then, after I went and reread Dr. Russell's paper, and looking back at the parts that I really liked and had marked with my, you know, double lines and a star, I thought, okay, now what would the doctrinal position be about this? And so I thought it might be worth just going back to a few of those to sort of establish the dialogue here. The first one is a quote from President McMurray, where he said, "We will listen to the life stories of each person who graces our fellowship and embrace them in love. On this, there can be no compromise." And I think from the more doctrinally driven side, the person would say, "Well, exactly. I agree with that completely. And also, there can be no compromise on teaching true doctrine. We do embrace the sinner. We embrace everyone in love, and if it is a sinner, we embrace them as well, but we do not embrace the sin, and we cannot be accepting of things that people in the congregation may do if those things are contrary to doctrine." And the pastor who responded to the prohibition of homosexuals holding church office, "But what if God calls a homosexual?" Well, I think the response to that would probably be something like, "Well, God doesn't call homosexuals, and if you think that God has, then you're mistaken. It's quite clear that this would not happen." Okay, next one. "If the saints value love and lifetime commitment, why does the church withhold its blessing simply because the two people happen to be of the same sex?" Well, and I think probably the response here would be something like, "Well, because eternal marriage is such a central part of LDS doctrine," and I don't know if that is... No. Okay.
I'm just happy if we get through this one.
Yeah. Given that eternal marriage is such an important part of LDS doctrine, very important. And so that is why it matters in this life. Finally, I wondered, I wondered if church administrators have any idea of the pain they inflict on good Christian people when they enforce rules that are based on principles which are contrary to the moral teachings of Jesus Christ, who taught the worth of all people. And I think the response to this one would be something like, yes, of course, all people have worth. Homosexuals have worth. Jesus Christ taught us to love one another, and part of loving one another is to helping each other out of our sin. And if that requires inflicting a little pain to jumpstart the process, maybe that's a small price to pay. Unfortunately, the pain inflicted is not a small amount. It's immense, and I think it does get underestimated, tremendously underestimated. So, in short, then, the doctrine is this. All people are fundamentally heterosexual, created that way by God. Eternal marriage is central to God's plan, and through agency, everyone who has homosexual desires can resist them. Now, decades ago, doctrine seemed to suggest, on the basis that everyone is fundamentally, in their most essential nature, is actually heterosexual. This doctrine, I think, suggested that, well, therefore, people who have homosexual desires can be changed. So let's work on some kind of therapies to figure out how to do this. Well, now, decades later, those attempts have proven to be futile. If there have been any successes at all, they have been very few and far between. So the facts themselves sort of raised themselves up in this issue and caused doctrine actually to be reconsidered. And Dallin Oakes, in his paper, which is a well-done paper, he researched it and thought it out very carefully. Dallin Oakes, this was written in 1995, he acknowledges that maybe this is the case, that homosexuals may not be able to change their desires. And this is how he says that in a rather subtle fashion. There is much we do not know about the extent of freedom we have in view of the various thorns in the flesh that afflict us in mortality. Right, so the extent of freedom may not extend to the ability to, through some sort of therapy, change these desires. Then he goes on and says, but this much we do know. We all have our free agency, and God holds us accountable for the way we use it in thought and deed. So even though the desires may be present, we are still, through agency, accountable for what we do. And I just had one thought about that. Maybe the facts about the capacity of people to remain celibate are not entirely understood either. If the doctrine says that homosexuals can and should be celibate through agency, what if homosexuals can't all remain celibate? Paul, in 1 Corinthians 7, where he's talking, I mean, Paul was no fan of marriage. He said it's better not to be married, but lots of people just can't remain celibate, and for those folks, it's better if you are married so that you don't commit the sin of fornication. And he refers to celibacy as a gift that he has, but lots of people don't. Well, if heterosexuals don't all have this gift of celibacy, there's every reason to suppose that people with heterosexual desires, whom I would call actually homosexuals, may not have the gift of celibacy either. And what are they supposed to do? If they can't remain celibate and they can't marry, there is no church-sanctioned relationship to enable them and to encourage them to live with one other person in a satisfying relationship. What are they supposed to do? I mean, there is no option for them other than failure. And so This fact about the human capacity for celibacy, right, that maybe it can't be overcome by agency. Maybe it's like blinking or sleeping, right? We can decide when to blink and we can decide when not to blink, but after a while, you just have to blink. Your body does it, right? Same with sleeping, pretty much. You can decide, okay, I'm going to take a nap and you go to sleep, or you can decide I've got all this work to do and I'm going to stay awake for 52 hours. But eventually, your body takes over and you go to sleep. And I think maybe in sexual matters with lots of people, eventually the body just takes over. And if that's the case, there really ought to be, it seems to me, some sort of other option for homosexuals so that they aren't doomed to failure. And it would seem to me that the sort of option that would be appropriate would be either allowing marriage or perhaps, if not calling it marriage, some other officially recognized kind of commitment bond so that these people don't feel like they're constantly inferior in this respect. Okay, I guess that's the end of my comment.
Questions for either of the two? From anybody?
I'm sorry. Bill, if I understand you correctly, what you're saying is that you think it would be a civil rights issue?
Well, it just...
Do you need to come here?
Okay, where does that... Does anybody know?
Well, that's what that Ken Robinson report suggested, and I don't think, you know... Yeah. Paul asked, is it true it's going to be fought on, as a civil rights question? I think that's logical that it be conceived of as a civil rights matter, I think that's just the language that Ken Robinson's report used. I mean, and I think the kind of suggestion that Bob just made would be legitimate. Well, it's just not so much as civil rights. Well, it's... Well, I guess I haven't really thought of it in that sense. I just think the specific issues of ordination, specific issues of some kind of legal or sacramental or priestly kind of recognition, those things occur on a case-by-case basis. That's why I favor Klaus Hansen's Alorarchy. In those localities like, St. Paul, Minnesota, and Kevin's congregation and so forth, the people there simply do what they think is right because they feel that it doesn't make any sense to deny some of the best people they've got in their midst that status. And then a couple, like the couple in Indianapolis, I've met these two people in Indianapolis, and they presented at Graceland one time, and, wonderful people. I'm not surprised that the people in Indianapolis, that the couple weren't sure they could trust, ended up wanting to come to that commitment ceremony. So I just think the policy will trickle up rather than trickle down, I hope. In the front row here.
Does the RPLS Church have a really?
Yeah. I would say from Grant McMurray on down, most of us don't have a foggiest idea of where we came from before we got here and don't have a foggiest idea where we're going to head after we die. Now, granted, we used to quote Section 76 and the glories. But have you heard glories? Anybody else that's RLDS here heard glories talked about or life after death talked about in RLDS church? I mean, it's been decades since I've heard anybody talk about that. But that might not be getting what I should really.
Also, did you guys prevent Black from holding
the priesthood? Oh, no. Only in the sense that socially, I'm sure there are congregations that should have ordained some blacks along the way. And I don't want to sugarcoat this. Blacks often had problems in our church, often had some of the same lack of acceptance, but we did. Joseph Smith III, one of his first revelations was 1865, admitting blacks to the priesthood. So officially, our church was always committed to blacks in the priesthood. Just they had many of the same social problems that blacks had everywhere. Yeah, I think we have a few less. I think we have a few less stumbling blocks. The eternal stuff is a big stomach block, I think, for you folks, which we don't have to worry about. Second row.
Bill, I just want to say thanks, especially coming from an LDS background.
Mm-hmm. I think it would be nice if there was a RLDS, LDS kind of gala type of association out here. I don't know if that'd be possible to get one going.
There should be some. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that would be good. Now, the gala people, although I don't know of anybody in gala around here, but I'm sure some contacts could be made and so forth. Brennan.
I'd like Bill and Bob Wolf, Gaines, and female.
Mm-hmm. Well, here's my hypothesis. My hypothesis is that that women, you know, this might be kind of, you know, not everybody agree with this, but I think women on the average are more spiritual than men. Gays, on the average, are more spiritual than straights. And yet for centuries, the churches, you know, restricted the top leadership positions, the priesthood, whatever they call it, to straight men. Well, if you feel that the dominant groups in society will typically create rules and regulations to support their dominance in society, and since religious symbols and the religious symbols of a society are very important, and those who exercise those symbols have significant power in that society, it's not surprising then that straight men, in retaining their dominance in society, have created rules that assist them, and the religious rules are an important part of those rules. So some people, I'm sure, a lot of people probably disagree with that. But yeah, Bob.
Yeah, I have a really hard time assessing people's spirituality. It's a real subtle sort of thing. But of the ones that I know in my own church who are gay or lesbian, they all are above average in terms of what they contribute to the church.
And women in our church, you know, come in a higher percentage, and in many ways, if you try to do a careful study, I think you'd conclude, you know, on average, mm-hmm. women in the Arledale Church would appear to be more spiritual than the men.
Right.
Next question. Mel.
Well, I look at the...
Yeah. Yeah. But on the other hand, and I'm not trying to downplay your statement at all, because I can't judge that, and I think you're probably right. It's really extremely hard. But on the other hand, in support of Mel's statement, institutions, it seems to me, and you've given a good example of it, institutions as well as humans, if they really want to rationalize a change, really want to rationalize something, boy, we can create great mental leaps in justifying what we want to do.
I agree with that. And it seems to me there might be an intermediary or intermediate step for the LDS Church, and I mean, surely this will be a very long process, but the intermediate step might be something like acknowledging that homosexuals, for the most part, cannot become non-homosexual. They should not be expected to remain celibate. And so in this life, at least, sort of strapped to this mortal coil, accommodations need to be made. Now, and so, I mean, through a social process like this, maybe there will be greater acceptance, less sense of condemnation, and so on. With the idea, of course, that after a person dies and the body is gone, with this constraining homosexuality coming from it, then the person is free to experience their true heterosexual nature, right? And well, I mean, and this is very consistent. I'm not making this up in a sense that in this article by Dallin Oakes, right, he says, you know, if for some reason a person really wants to be doing the right thing, but they, you know, something stands in the way, they'll still have a chance to endure this life, right? And so, I mean, I think there is, and maybe it's rationalization, uh-huh. but I think there is this route that could be followed without having to go to the very deepest levels of theological change. I mean, the problem with that, as I see it, is that it still puts the homosexual in a position of being having something wrong with them,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
That will be corrected later.
Well, we've got about 30 seconds left. If anybody wants a final comment or question, we have just a tiny bit of time. Well, let me say then, if anybody would like a copy of my paper, my email address is a very simple one. I teach at Graceland College, and it's simply Russell, two L's in Russell, russell@graceland.edu, and email me and ask me for a copy of the paper, and I'll fire you one back on email. So sometimes people after word will ask for a copy, and it's so much easier now if they've got email. So be happy to send you a copy if you want one. Thanks very much. Russell@Graceland, it's one word, Graceland College, graceland.edu. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you.